Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, a fine, powerful, and classic talk by Chris Hedges. It's from 2011, and not a word needs to be changed. I hope you'll stay tuned. Remember Barack Obama? Of course you do. By all accounts, Barack Obama is a moral, ethical, intelligent, and very decent human being. By contrast, I have heard President Trump's morals and ethics compared to a dumpster fire. I think the comparison is unfair to dumpsters. But I think that what counts most is not character, but rather policies. And the policies Obama put in place were in the same ballpark as Trump's. No, not as bad, but same ballpark. More monopolies, serve the wishes of the rich, ignore the poor, take tax dollars from the working class, and give them to the rich bankers and hedge fund managers. Do nothing for average Americans, even in the worst depression in 70 years, while bailing out the bankers that caused the disaster. Bankrupt everybody with military spending and imperialism. Everybody but savvy investors, that is. Do nothing to halt the climate crisis. And let's not forget Obama's well-earned nickname, Deporter-in-Chief. This is a roundabout way of introducing a fine and classic talk by journalist and prophet Chris Hedges. Hedges gave the talk in Seattle in 2011, halfway through Obama's first term. In the age of Trump, it may sound odd to hear scathing criticism of Obama and Bill Clinton, but there you have it. In more recent years, Chris Hedges has repeatedly said, "Trump is the symptom, he's not the disease." Hedges is right. The disease that is destroying all that we value is not Trump, still less Clinton, the two Bushes, or Obama. As Hedges sees it, the disease has a name, and its name is American-style corporate capitalism. We will hear Hedges' fine talk in two installments, this week and next. From Seattle, June 29, 2011, here is Chris Hedges.
This book had its genesis in the last two books that I wrote, Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy, and The Triumph of Spectacle, which was a look at how we have been effectively unplugged from the reality around us. I think we're probably the most illusioned society on the planet. The mantra that reality is never an impediment to what we want, which is fed to us across the political and cultural spectrum, whether that's Oprah or the Christian right, or positive psychology, or self-help gurus, or Hollywood. And of course, it's a form not only of magical thinking, but infantilism. It essentially creates a population that never grows up. And as that gap opens up between the illusion of who we think we are and where we think we're headed and the reality, when that gap widens to such an extent that reality is no longer deniable, when it's our home that is foreclosed, when we finally grasp that that job that we lost is not coming back and will never appear for our children, there is a tendency in such societies to react as children, which is to call for a demagogue, a savior, moral renewal, and vengeance. And I think we see on the outer fringes of American society embodied in groups like the Tea Party and militias and a lunatic fringe of the Republican Party, and just about anybody who speaks on Fox News, that this frightening form of proto-fascism is very real. The next book that I wrote was Death of the Liberal Class, which looked at the pillars of the liberal establishment. What happened? How did we reach a point where we had become disempowered? And that book led me back to World War I, which I think was a seminal moment in American history, because on the eve of the war, you had numerous radical, populist, progressive movements that were threatening the control of the power elite. We had over 70 socialist mayors in this country. Appeal to Reason had the fourth highest circulation, a socialist journal. Eugene Debs in 1912 pulled 6%, 900,000 votes. And as Dwight MacDonald, a writer I admire very much, pointed out, the war was the rock on which these movements broke. Because what was instituted was the first system of modern mass propaganda, the Committee for Public Information, or the Creel Commission, because it was led by a former muckraking journalist named George Creel, which employed for the first time the understandings of crowd psychology pioneered by Le Bon, Trotter, and Sigmund Freud. And Edward Bernays, the father of modern public relations, comes out of the Creel Commission, Freud's nephew through marriage twice over. His book, After the War, Propaganda, becomes a seminal text that Goebbels uses when building the Nazi propaganda machine. And it was this understanding that people were not moved by fact or reason, but by the manipulation of emotion, what Walter Lippmann in his book Public Opinion calls the manufacturing of consent. That is where Chomsky and Herman get the title for their book on the media a few decades later. When you read Randolph Bourne or Jane Addams, who held out against this propaganda, and the Creel Commission had, of course, the resources of the state, public speakers fanned out across the country. It had its own news division, which pumped out daily press, pro-war press stories. It had its own film division, which made movies like The Kaiser, The Butcher of Berlin, and stuff like this. The debate, it's interesting, the debate at the beginning when they were first going into the war between Wilson and Lippmann, and that argument over whether they would have to use the coercive measures of the Espionage Act or the Sedition Act to control the population. The war had very little popular support, and of course we were pushed into the war because of the Wall Street, the collapse of the Eastern Front, collapse of Tsarist Russia, raised the specter that the Kaiser could move over 100 divisions over to the Western Front, and if Britain and France were defeated, then those tremendous loans that Wall Street had given Britain and France would never be repaid. I mean, this was really a banker's war. There's sort of nothing new in that. When Bourne and Adams write, they talk about, in fact, how easily the intellectual and even the radical class is seduced into the war effort. That's a constant theme in their writings, that kind of despair. So, in fact, the harsher measures of control were really reserved for those recalcitrant few who were not seduced by the propaganda. Debs himself, of course, who ends up in prison under Wilson. And the war effectively begins the dismantling of radical and populist movements, which is absolutely a crucial turning point in American history. Those movements, it's only been movements that have, and Zinn does a very good job of pointing this out in the People's History of the United States, which I teach at a correctional facility, and there is some benefit to having an illiterate ruling class. I submitted my form to teach the inmates American history, and the prison officials thought this was just wonderful. And then I went out and bought every inmate a copy of The People's History of the United States. I never met Zinn, a huge admirer of him, but after teaching him to African-American inmates, I realized what a magnificent moral and intellectual voice he was. I would give 90-minute talks built around whatever chapter we were studying, and I would hear inmates go, "Damn, damn, we've been lied to." But Zinn's very cognizant that, you know, the founding fathers, which are sort of deified often by the liberal class along with the ruling class, never wanted a popular democracy. They were terrified of popular democracy. Of course, they disenfranchised the majority of people in this country, African Americans, Native Americans, women, people without property, indentured servants, and then created mechanisms within the system, like the Electoral College and the Senate, where the senators used to be appointed, so that popular rule would never be achieved. The magnificence of Zinn's work is this study of how that opening up of American society was obtained with the sweat, toil, sacrifice, and blood of the disenfranchised and the American working class. The power elite certainly understood the danger of these movements, and they used the war to break them. Dwight MacDonald writes of that moment after the war of a transition in American society into what he calls the psychosis of permanent war. And he says none of the political theorists of the 19th century, including Karl Marx, anticipated this psychosis of permanent war where, in MacDonald's words, you can get the masses to call for their own enslavement. So after the war, the dreaded Hun becomes the dreaded Red. Everybody from the Committee for Public Information goes straight to Madison Avenue and starts working on behalf of corporations. And they upend traditional American values of self-effacement, thrift, community, to instill this cult of the self, hedonism, and consumption as a kind of inner compulsion. I think when we talk about American values or American culture, at this point, what we're really talking about is corporate culture. And they used the Espionage and the Sedition Act to essentially wipe out those radical movements that were left behind, including the Wobblies. Big Bill Haywood has to flee the country, spends the last decade of his life in Moscow. Joe Hill, of course, is on trumped-up murder charges, hung in Utah. The masses is shut down, appeal to reason is shut down. Even though there was a policy during the war that you could only publish if you had a pro-war editorial stance, which is why the masses wouldn't publish, appeal to reason did, and even then they were shut down. That's how you have Emma Goldman, Alexander Berkman deported. The breaking of those radical movements was accompanied by the disemboweling of the liberal class itself in the name of anti-communism, culminating, of course, with the witch hunts, the Red Scare of the 1950s, when everything was obliterated. Thousands of university professors, high school teachers, social workers. It used to be that social workers, the unions, would advocate on behalf of their clients, artists, writers, directors, journalists like I.F. Stone, who becomes a pariah. He can't even get a job at The Nation magazine, and he ends up starting I.F. Stone's Weekly in his basement. The progressive forces are pushed out. The liberal forces are hollowed out. Figures like Sidney Hook, who had flirted with Trotskyism, becomes, he names names. And the liberal class itself ceases to function. The function of the liberal class, of course, is not to serve as the political left in a capitalist democracy. The function of the liberal class is to serve as a safety valve. So when then grievances and injustices become extensive within the underclass, it makes possible incremental or piecemeal reform. And that's why when Conrad Black writes his biography of Roosevelt, he says that Roosevelt's greatest achievement was that he saved capitalism. The breakdown of the liberal class means that that incremental reform is no longer possible. And it's interesting that this is a constant theme in Dostoevsky's work. At the end of the 19th century in Russia, that's what his novel Demons is about, that's what Notes from Underground is about. It's Mouse Man, it's the defeated dreamer who went to all the Obama rallies and chanted, "Yes, we can," and now is just cynical and in despair. And Dostoevsky says when that liberal center doesn't work, when essentially you have a government that is gripped by paralysis, which is something that I saw in the former Yugoslavia, then you enter an age of moral nihilism. So without the populist movements and without, in the end, a functioning liberal class that was able to safeguard some of the interests of the vulnerable within the society and, of course, the working class, you give rise to these monstrosities such as Bill Clinton. Clinton speaks in that traditional feel your pain, like Obama, feel your pain language of liberalism, and yet serves corporate interests. So under Clinton, we get the destruction of welfare, we get the deregulation of the FCC, which is not a small act because it essentially has allowed a half dozen corporations, Viacom, General Electric, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, Disney, Clear Channel, to buy up the airwaves. And we've been reduced in this political theater to investing our emotional energy in what is nothing more than court gossip. And that's what MSNBC does, and that's what Fox does. They spin it in a different direction. But it's the same inanities, whether it's Newt's moon colonies or Ann Romney's horse. The real issues that confront the American citizens as they are rapidly stripped of power are never addressed over the commercial airwaves. And of course, it's Clinton who destroys the banking system, which triggers the economic meltdown of 2008. But Clinton was well paid for it. So by the 1990s, the Democratic Party had fundraising parity with the Republicans, and when Barack Obama ran for president in 2008, he got more. And so the obvious question is, with all of the restraints and impediments lifted against corporate capitalism, with nothing to check that predatory nature of corporate capitalism, what happens? And what Joe and I did was go to the sacrifice zones of the country, those places that had been offered up to the marketplace first. And of course, it all began with westward expansion and the seizure of the land, the violation of the treaties, and the acts of genocide carried out against Native Americans, propelled by gold speculators, timber speculators, freighters, the railroad barons. And what you saw in the final stages of the crushing of Native culture was not simply the seizure of land and the decimation of a peoples, but the destruction of a competing ethic of how to exist on the planet. Within Native societies, anybody who hoarded goods for themselves was despised. Everything was communal, and there was an understanding that life was sacred, including the natural world. Carl Polanyi, in 1944, wrote a great book called The Great Transformation about unfettered capitalism, which, like Marx, he calls a revolutionary force that has built within it its own quality of self-destruction. Because, as Polanyi writes, when you commodify everything, when human beings become a commodity, when the natural world becomes a commodity, you exploit those forces until exhaustion or collapse, which is why the environmental crisis is intimately twinned with the economic crisis. These sacrifice zones, we were in Pine Ridge, South Dakota, are forms of violence. And the violence visited by the forces of oppression on those who live within these sacrifice zones destroys their capacity to sustain themselves both economically and morally. The average life expectancy of a male on Pine Ridge is 48. That is the lowest in the Western Hemisphere outside of Haiti. There is an estimated 80% alcoholism rate. And at any one time, 60% of the dwellings have neither electricity or water. And of course, these people, like all the people in our sacrifice zones, are invisible. And that's why, for me, it was so important to work with Joe. Over 50 pages of the book are graphic panels. He can give a kind of filmic quality to lives and illustrations to make those who live within in these zones visible to the reader in a way that in simple prose is often difficult. We then went to Camden, New Jersey, which per capita is the poorest city in the United States and also, not surprisingly, one of the most dangerous. Most urban centers have fallen into decay, but some parts of those urban centers remain functional. In Camden, it is a completely dead city, and this was one of the industrial hubs of the Northeast. At its height, the shipyards in Camden employed 36,000 people. RCA Victor was there. Campbell's Soup was there. And in Camden, everything went. There are whole blocks that are just deserted with literally trees growing out of the roofs. The only two businesses that function are the roughly 100 open-air drug markets and this huge scrap metal business on the river, because you have armies of foragers who go into the abandoned buildings and rip out all the piping and the screen doors, anything, bring it down to the port where it's crushed up, and ships from China, Turkey, India come and literally take the guts of this American city overseas to smelt it down. We went from there to West Virginia, the coal fields in southern West Virginia, where coal companies who own everyone, all politicians, I mean, they even write the school textbooks so that big coal is painted in classrooms as sort of the savior of West Virginia. And because they don't want to dig down for coal anymore, they just blow the top 400 feet off of the mountains to get to the coal seams. They are doing this with some of the largest land equipment on earth, 25-foot story drag lines, giant bulldozers, and they will literally push all of the trees and topsoil over the edge and light it on fire. And we flew over this wasteland. And these are the lungs of the eastern seaboard. Much of the headwaters of the eastern seaboard come out of the Appalachian Mountains. And it's just a moonscape with raging lit fires. It's an act of collective suicide for quarterly profit. And, of course, the consequences are that the air is poisoned, the water is poisoned. We went into villages in southern West Virginia where everybody has had their gallbladder removed because the water is so toxic. You walk into the nurse's office in an elementary school, and there are rows of little inhalers for the children. Cancer is an epidemic, and self-medication to cope with that despair, hillbilly heroin, is widespread, Oxycontin. We are people we interviewed in the book, who young men who a few weeks later had died of overdoses. That sort of bifurcation in these sacrifice zones into either anesthetizing yourself through opiates, alcohol, it was either that or clinging to religious belief. And not necessarily Christian. In Pine Ridge, it was Lakota traditions, sweat lodges. We went to a sun dance, deeply moving, 4 days of fasting, dancing around a cottonwood tree, young men often with their prison tattoos struggling to pull their lives back together. In all of those pockets, there were figures, heroic figures, who resisted and yet did within the book articulate how power worked. And it wasn't that they necessarily had hope that they could overcome the forces arrayed against them. But as Hannah Arendt understood, she said that finally when one embraces the moral life, it's not done by those who say I shouldn't or I oughtn't, but it's done by those who say I can't. The fourth chapter was out of Immokalee, Florida, the produce fields, because as Bernie Sanders said after he visited Immokalee, in the race to the bottom that has become America, Immokalee is the bottom. There you have the perfect worker in the corporate state, utterly disempowered, no legal rights, no benefits, no protection. There's three families in Immokalee that control the trailer parks. These are trailers that should have been condemned years ago, holes in the floorboards, rats, cockroaches. They'll put 20 mattresses down on the floor, and you pay $50 a week. That's $2,000 a month these people are making to live in that trailer, and then you have to go to the collection points at 4 in the morning and hope that crew leaders pick you, put them on the bus, and take you out to the fields. And if you can't work enough that week and turn in your $50, you sleep under a mango tree or out on the outskirts of the town in a wooded area in places that we visited. And it's not surprising that there are just constant discoveries of slavery, where workers are held against their will. Their families are threatened in Mexico or Honduras or Guatemala if they report to authorities. and we interviewed some of them. Sometimes those slave encampments can run into a few hundred workers who are often held behind barbed wire. And as corporations, you know, have been able to reconfigure American society into a form of neo-feudalism, which of course they're doing with the global economy, you're finding the horrific conditions that workers, undocumented workers, endure in our produce fields being replicated in all sorts of other industries, from the hotel industry to meatpacking to everything else. And that's because we've lost the capacity to fight back through the formal mechanisms of power. The liberal establishment has essentially sold its soul. And here I would disagree with Thomas Franks in his book, What's the Matter with Kansas? You know, or he asks, why is it that these people vote against their own interests? I don't think they vote against their own interests. Of course, most people in this country just don't vote. I think they fully understand that the Democratic Party, especially after NAFTA, walked out on the working class of this country, turned their back on the working class in this country. And this sort of destruction, the internal destruction, I think it's what, 5 or 7% of jobs in this country are now manufacturing jobs. And the New York Times did a story a couple weeks ago where they looked at those middle class families that had lost their jobs in 2008 and found that in most cases, those who had found new jobs were working for salaries that were 40 or 50% less than what they were making before, without benefits. And that's, of course, where we're headed. We shifted in the 1970s, I suppose, from what the Harvard historian Charles Mayer calls an empire of production into an empire of consumption. And so the Obama administration, which has been nothing if not obsequious to corporate interests, and if any of you have followed Obamacare, you know fully what I'm speaking about. This health bill was hatched within the Heritage Foundation, which should be a huge tip-off to you that it's no good. It was first implemented in 2006 by then-Governor Romney. It then made its way to Washington, where its 2,000 pages were tweaked and written by corporate lobbyists, who inserted, of course, $447 billion in subsidies. That's why this is the equivalent of the bank bailout bill for the pharmaceutical and insurance industries, and why, of course, stocks today of pharmaceutical insurance industries have shot through the roof. They can still jack up copayments and premiums. If you get a serious illness, you're still not protected. And, of course, 1 million bankruptcies a year in this country are caused by people who can't pay their medical bills, and 80% of them had insurance. And the tragedy for me is that it's going to make it even harder for us to get the public option or Medicare for all, which is the only rational policy that should be implemented.
That was the first half of a talk, June 29, by Chris Hedges. Thank you for listening, and please come back next week for the second half. And remember, you are not alone. Ciao.